Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin using automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. I'm Brady, head of education at Swan. Every week, I host a conversation with Bitcoiners along with our founder, Corey Clipston, and sometimes co-founder Jan Pritzker joins us. We broadcast these live and then we publish the audio here on this podcast feed. We call these sessions Swan Signal Live. We pair up two Bitcoiners you have likely not heard together before, and we talk about the latest Bitcoin and macroeconomic news, about the technology, and we muse about Bitcoin's future. This week we are joined by Bitcoin Permabull, Bitcoin Tina, and Christian Careless, aka CK Snarks. He's the multimedia editor for Bitcoin Magazine. Be sure to follow at Swan Bitcoin on Twitter so you can tune in live there whenever you can. We also broadcast on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. But if you can't do it live, you'll always be able to catch all the Swan Signal Live conversations here on this podcast. I'm glad you found your way here. Hope you enjoy. All right, welcome to Swan Signal Live. It is the first Swan Signal Live of the fourth epic, having came and went as expected. TikTok having block came and went. We have two awesome guests to kick off the fourth epic today. Bitcoin Tina, welcome to Swan Signal, man. How are you doing?
Thanks, Brady. I'm doing great.
Glad can to you hear me? Yep, we got you.
Good, okay.
Glad to hear you are doing well. And we've got one of my favorite Bitcoiners, just a great dude all around, Christian CK Snarks. How's it going, man?
Doing good, man. And honored to be here as one of the first guests of the third epic with Bitcoin Tina. Oh, sorry, the fourth epic, yes.
Yeah, I'm always honored, and it is always a pleasure to hang with CK. We spent a lot of time together doing that four-part series, and I'm a huge fan of CK. I'm also a huge fan of yours too, Brady. So I kiss everybody's ass here.
I appreciate that. The feeling's mutual all around. We aren't even drinking, but it's already gotten to the I love you man stage, which is great. Gotta have some love going around in times like this. Before we started recording, we were talking about these times we find ourselves in, and Tina had very aptly stated that the cure may be worse than the disease at this point. Why don't you keep going with that take, and let's talk a little bit about this macro situation we find ourselves in from this COVID situation.
Well, I guess observationally, look, I'm older than most Bitcoiners in the space, and I may be higher risk. And so for me, I probably need to be more careful than other people might need to be. And I'm willing to be more careful, and I'm willing to live accordingly. I think that it's useful that people adopt the idea of also being concerned and maybe do things like wear masks. But I also think that we have to get the economy open. There are millions of people out of work. These people have got to get back to work. There are businesses that are going to wind up closed. We can't lose these businesses. You have people have to be able to. We live with risk every day. To be alive is to live with risk. Now, we can live with risk in a foolish way. We can live with risk in a smart way. I opt for living with risk in a smart way. And I think that we can't ignore the risk of having an economy closed down. I think there are tremendous risks with that. I think there are tremendous risks to people's health, to people's life, to people's incomes. And these are very real risks too. So we have to find a balancing act in what is a very, very difficult time. And I don't like what I've seen in terms of the nature of this enforcement. It feels very totalitarian to me. It feels very Orwellian. It feels very unthinking and uncaring. And I don't like that. And I think that's a problem. I hope it wakens some people up to the idea of the dangers of that sort of situation for the United States and hopefully for other countries as well. I think if it does awaken people to those kinds of problems, then in some sense, this will have been a good thing. But at this point, we've got to figure out a way to make it work. We can't just continue to live in this scaredemic, we have to find some happy medium.
Yeah, it is definitely worrisome. The fallout. I mean, I've been saying this from the very beginning. I think most of us have, who have been watching what's going on in the economy and keeping up with things. Bitcoiners have been waiting for this kind of everything bubble to burst for a long time, dreading it for sure, but thankful that we have this alternative in place, at least. And you know, this situation, this shutdowns, you know, mandated / voluntary shutdown that we're in now is probably the pin. Jay Powell came out this morning to make some comments, and I want to get into those. But first, CK, I wanted to get your take on, you know, the situation where we are with economically speaking.
I mean, I'm definitely not an expert, and I'm definitely not one to make recommendations for what we should do. But I guess I'll comment on what I think we're doing wrong. And I really think that the fact that we are taking a very top-down federal government mandate approach is the problem. I can understand New York being completely shut down. That makes sense. When you go and you see videos of a mother in Iowa being arrested for pushing her daughter on a swing, like in bumfuck nowhere, essentially, like it really makes no sense, right? For every single person in every single jurisdiction in every single state and city to be under the same exact kind of rules. And it really indicates why localism and local decision making is so important. And I think that the best thing about what is happening right now is that we get to have a lot of experiments across the globe of different attempts to quell this virus. And we're going to see in real time what works and what doesn't. And we're going to see in real time which states really abuse their power and which states don't. And I think this vision of really consumers having more choice of jurisdiction is going to become a lot more appealing. And it's going to become a lot more obvious. So I'm just, you know, I see signs of nation states breaking down, of localism, the advantage of localism kind of being highlighted. And I'm sad by really a lot of law enforcement and executives and people that are kind of like part of the state using this as an excuse to be inhumane and to, you know, flex their power.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that completely. The this sort of just very blunt approach, this top-down approach, is, you know, it's inefficient in a lot of cases, but in a situation like this, it's probably even more impactful. You know, like here in Kansas City, we're really just starting to get kind of approach the peak of our you know, infection rates and hospitals really kind of filling up. We didn't need to be shut down for the past 2 months. You know, this thing spreads in waves to different places of the world, geographically speaking. So yeah, having the ability to have more local control over shutdowns makes a ton of sense. And I think in a Bitcoin world, we'll probably see more empowerment of local governments. At least that's sort of my hope and what I see, you know, happening. What do you guys think about that? Like,
well, wait. I want to correct something from my perspective, because I see it a little differently than CK. I think that it's been thrown into the hands of the states, and I think what we've seen is we've seen people make a bit of a political football out of this whole thing.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I'm not sure that I don't think you have the federal government trying to run the shutdown show. I think the shutdown show is getting run on a state by state basis, and you have Democrats in states like Illinois with Pritzker, Newsom in California, I can't remember her name in Michigan, and other democratically elected Democratic Party states, where they are using the shutdown in ways that don't make any sense to me. I heard a while back that in the Home Depot, in maybe it was Michigan, I don't remember what state it was, they literally taped off areas that you were not allowed to buy things because they were deemed non-essential. What if something in your house broke and you needed to buy something to fix it? That seems pretty essential to me. So we've created a bit of an artificialness, and like everything else in this country, this has become another political battleground. So I'm not so sure that I agree with the idea that it's being controlled from the federal level down. I don't actually think it is. I think this is become a political football, and this is what's disturbing to me. I question some of these states that have shut down and are pretty much following the leader. And I've seen actions that really seem pretty repugnant to me by some of these local politicians. And even if you have cases, we're likely going to have cases, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to be in a shutdown because you have cases. I thought we were going to have literally tens of millions of people sick in the United States. I thought by now we'd potentially have 500,000 to 1 million people dead in this country. That's what I thought was going to be the case. That's not the case. Those are not the numbers at this point. The numbers are bad. They're not that. And so the question becomes, how do we find a way of living with this thing? And we can't let this be a political football. You had Fauci warning that we're going to have schools shut down. Now, maybe schools should be shut down. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we'll have more homeschooling. I actually would like that idea because I'd like less indoctrination. But we have issues that are going to come out of this. We're going to have issues of domestic abuse, child abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse. And there are a lot of pathologies that come from unemployment. There are a lot of pathologies from people being stuck at home. This is really serious. And the negative pathological social outcomes that are coming from this are really quite severe. And I thought we needed to treat this very seriously at the beginning. And I still don't think we can ignore it. I think we need to figure out ways of finding some middle ground, but this can't be a political football. And I think it has become a bit of a political football. So I have a slightly different view than CK does on this, and maybe you too, Brady. But I think that we've turned this into another political football for this country, which I'm not happy about.
So just to jump in, I am thankful that there, at least in the United States, is a variance between states, whereas other countries that don't have kind of strong state rights or province rights or whatever, they don't have that. It's much more top down. It is what it is from the top. So I think that that's actually a benefit for the U.S. We live in a political world. I don't see anything that affects massive amounts of people not becoming a political football in our current system. I think Mr. Cool BP, one of the guys behind WTF, happened in 1971, made a really great point that it is a shame that this happened during peak fiat. It's a shame that it happened when so many elderly people were just shoved into homes because their children can't take care of them anymore. It's a shame that it happened when no one had any cash whatsoever. So the political football is inevitable because we are living in this political fiat time. And I think that that's just happening, but I am grateful that there are different jurisdictions trying different things. So at least we can see right in front of us. And I really do think that the fact that this originated in China and that the Chinese, Communist Party was the one that reacted first to this really created a mold for other governments to copy for how to react to this. And I think that if the word had started somewhere else, we may have seen different policies coming from different governments. But the fact that it happened in China, we saw China's reaction to it, that was obviously draconian and crazy and welding doors shut and stuff like that. And a lot of governments use that as a model, and that and we allowed it we allowed China's response to teach us how to respond. And that's why we're seeing things, you know, so crazy. And nothing scares me more than things like videos from Australia, US, Canada, where police officers are just acting in completely inhumane ways to, you know, to enforce the law.
Well, yeah,
go ahead, Tina.
If we learn from the Chinese, then we really have a big problem on our hands, because there's nothing about the communist Chinese that I like. So I think that's a pretty bad model from my perspective. There are other Asian nations that, you know, took pretty aggressive approaches, and they mostly started doing things like wearing masks. I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think the people in Japan had this kind of a lockdown approach. It was nothing. I don't think it was enforcement like this. They haven't suffered from these kinds of problems. They're not the only country. I think there are other countries in Asia that did not take the same kind of approach that the Communist Chinese took. I think the Communist Chinese took that approach because they had an inkling as to what they were dealing with. And because they had this inkling of that this might have been a bioweapon, that they felt the need to take such drastic actions. And that's really a bit of a problem. But
or massive governments just have a hammer and all they know how to do is enforce regulation rather than, you know, making recommendations, admitting that they don't know what's happening, telling people to take precautions and be safe and letting people have any sort of personal responsibility. You know, governments do what governments do. And we had the worst government, you know, essentially be the example for the world. I see other Asian nations as not doing maybe what China did because they're used to this, because they're always affected by China. And they understand so closely what the Chinese Communist Party and life in China does to the rest of the world. If you go to Korea, if you go to Seoul, Korea, they literally have a tower that is in the city that changes lights based on the quality of air that's being blown in from China to warn the Korean citizens, hey, should you be wearing a mask today or not? All of China is just so intimately, or not all of Asia is so intimately, you know, aware of, you know, China and how to deal with China that they, you know, that explains to me why maybe they acted differently. Whereas, you know, in the U.S., you have you have senators and pundits talking about how this just proves that central down authority is the only way to do things, which I think is the opposite takeaway of what Tina and I are describing.
I still actually believe in this weird document we have called the Constitution.
Yeah, there's there's still a lot of information out there. I think one of the big issues was, like you said, Tina, that we were expecting potentially a much bigger impact from the virus. And, you know, it's it's impossible and difficult to try to model, right, this thing out when you don't have any information. And the information you do have is extremely unreliable. So making decisions based on these very early models on how things are going to spread is tough. However, I think when more information is coming out, then you have to adjust those models and the policies. I think we're seeing that more so in the United States. I think states have been kind of loosened up or freed to kind of make their own decisions. Even where I live, the county has a different policy than the state right now, in terms of lockdown and regulations on restaurants and other businesses. So that is good to see, that it's a little bit more surgical in that regard. I hope that we continue to get more information and make better decisions moving forward, but we still have, whatever happens, this economic fallout to deal with. Jay Powell was interviewed this morning and spoke about his prospects, which are pretty dim for the future of the, you know, U.S. economy and the world economy. He was very quick to blame the virus. He said, I think it was, I'll approximate here, but he said that the problem, the economic fallout was due to the virus and not because we were in the midst of a bubble, any kind of economic or credit bubble, which I think all of us will probably disagree with. And Stanley Druckenmiller, who was also interviewed last night, said, you know, the exact opposite, that we're in the midst of this massive credit bubble that might be popped by this virus. What do you guys think about Jay Powell's comments this morning? And I can summarize some more if you haven't been able to catch up with them.
You know,
I did not hear Jay Powell this morning. I want to just conclude one thing that from our prior conversation, because it's applicable to almost all things, and that is, it's okay to be wrong. And then learn this as a trader. I heard Richard Russell actually used to say this: it's okay to be wrong. It's not okay to stay wrong.
Right.
And we need to use this as a guiding principle for things that we do. It's okay to make mistakes. It's not okay to keep making mistakes. Jay Powell is very fortunate that he has this convenient thing that he can blame I think we have had the wrong diagnosis for problems for over a decade. But at this point, I've come to embrace policies of negative rates and UBI and money printing because from my perspective, it will just accelerate the process of Bitcoin. I see the system as being irreparably broken. I think it's been irreparably broken for decades. It's just been, we've been inexorably moving here. I have a statement that I like to say vis-a-vis Fed funds that 0% rates are an indication of failed policy. Negative rates are an indication of insanity. I think we've had monetary madness for 30 to 40 years. We've had bad policy at least since the crash of 87, the post-crash of 87. We had a brief moment in time when Volcker ran the Fed when he tried to correct things from the prior 30 some odd years where we had excessively easy policies. Those policies were tended to be high taxation and easy credit, which created a pretty bad inflation, which Volcker tamed with extremely high interest rates, which was very painful to the U.S. economy. Volcker was so roundly hated by so many people. He had Secret Service protection. He was burned in effigy. I think this go-round will ultimately have Bitcoin save the situation. People can buy into Bitcoin and ride Bitcoin's coattails into potentially a new economic system. It will be painful for some, and that's unfortunate, but the ultimate outcome will be dramatically better. But we've created a situation where we've created credit, which is too easy, which has created a form of debt slavery. We see this very much so with regard to student loans and what kids, young people have to pay for college and university. When I was in university a long time ago, it was much less expensive, even on a relative basis. We've had inflation to the tune of 9% or so compounded annually for 40 to 50 years. Hold on one second. Which is devastating. So you have young men, young women graduating college with questionable degrees, saddled with enormous mountains of debt. They can't really start their lives. They can't afford to start businesses. They can't afford to buy homes. This has been a disaster. We need to remake and redesign the way these educational services are delivered. We don't need free education. We need people to use the creativity and genius they have to find another way of delivering these services at a much lower cost. Look, it's great to have fun in college for 4 years and party and have a good time. I mean, who doesn't want to have a great time partying for 4 years? But at the end of the day, people can't afford to spend tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars partying for 4 years. That's not a world we live in, and that's a pretty high bill to pay. And sure, it's fun. Of course it's fun. Lots of things are fun. Doesn't mean we should do it. Doesn't mean we can afford to do it. Most people go to college and take courses because they want to improve their ability to earn an income. That's, you know, why vocational education exists.
I think that might be an outcome of this situation that we're in now is that, you know, lots of universities are going to online education, and similar to corporations and their work from home policies, it's going to be hard to justify needing to be on campus for every student needing to be on campus at all times, or every employee needing to be in the corporate office at all times after this situation.
Have you heard any of them looking to give back money to their students? Have you heard any of them talking about cutting their costs and cutting what they're charging them? I haven't heard any news items. I'm sure it would have been big if some universities came out and said, oh, tuition next year will only be 10% of last year's tuition. I haven't heard that. Did I miss that in the news?
I don't think you missed it.
I went to college recently, and just looking at tuition prices at my university from just 5 years ago to what they are today, they are mooning. They are experiencing hyperinflation or appreciation or whatever, in terms of like the cost of college, it's now 25% more expensive, my unbelievably expensive tuition costs, which just like absolutely blows my mind.
Got a related question from the chat room from Al's Lacrosse. For Tina and CK, you can definitely weigh in as well. What does Tina see as the trigger for the tipping point of traditional finance buying Bitcoin over treasuries? Are negative interest rates enough, or does more need to happen?
Oh, that's we're a long way from there. I don't even think about that. Bitcoin versus treasuries. Bitcoin is way too small an asset to even consider that. That's not a question for several years, at least, maybe.
So, I mean, what needs to happen?
7 to 10 years from now.
Do you think it's a certain Bitcoin
market? Never go up.
Yeah. Do you think it's a certain Bitcoin market cap that would need to be reached in order for that to be considered?
Bitcoin will become perceived as the riskless asset. It's not perceived as that yet. So right now, I think we're primed for extremely high numbers. I wanted to come in and tell people that pretty strongly that I think you should stop thinking about trying to acquire more Bitcoin and should figure out a way to make sure you don't sell the Bitcoin you have too cheap. I think that people undervalue what they own. I think that many, not hodlers, because I think hodlers have a different mentality, and you probably have mostly hodlers listening to this. I'm probably not talking to the trading types, and they won't listen to me. They'll think I'm an idiot. They'll think I'm foolish. And I think that in the course of the next several years, I think Plan B is probably right. My own mental model for this coming bull market was a range of $200,000 to $400,000 in Bitcoin pricing. Plan B says in his cross asset model, he's got a target. Hold on 1 second. Sorry about that. I'm just going to take a sip of water here.
Yeah, so his target's 288,000, if I remember correctly.
His target's 288,000, and I don't think that's crazy at all. And I think we'll overshoot that by a fair bit.
That would put us at like a $5 trillion market cap. Still too small for financial institutions, you know, to buy Bitcoin over treasuries. What do you think?
Treasury market's like a less marketable treasuries. I have to back into this. There's around $5 to $6 trillion in intergovernmental loans, and so the balance would be marketable. So you're talking probably about approximately a $20 trillion marketable treasury market, plus or minus $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty big market. Bitcoin is not going to be a substitute for treasuries for a number of years. I think the asset grows dramatically larger in the course of the next decade through the various cycles we're going through. And maybe that'll be a more reasonable discussion to be had in 2025, 2027, 2029. Yeah. I think it's too soon, too presumptuous, and completely unnecessary to even have that discussion. Bitcoin's going to go up an awful lot in the next number of years. And I expect in this cycle, the numbers will be shocking. I tend to think that I have some radical notions in Bitcoin. Pretty much everything I think about Bitcoin is generally radical. So I think if you're guiding...
It sounds like you're getting bearish to me, Tina.
You're guiding
you said like 8 years or something? I'm like, what's this?
eight years, I'm talking like, you know, $5-6 million Bitcoin. I'm not sure how bearish that is. I think that you're going to have massive up moves with a greatly diminished downward pricing in bear markets. I think the up cycles are going to be absolutely staggering. Put yourself in other people's shoes. So I've seen this in markets. Remember, people who've been in markets for a long time, they forget when new people come in, they look at it differently. And they're looking for making money. I mean, if you're selling to them, you think it's going down. They think it's going up. So forget about short-term basis, but people who are buying it, the question is, what are they looking at as far as potential price? If you've been told that Bitcoin is nonsense and it's garbage and it's silly, and you're looking at a Bitcoin price of $250,000 Bitcoin, I forget how many, let's see, at $1 million, that's a penny a sat. So you can buy 4 sats for a penny. So you're looking at Bitcoin priced at 4 sats to the penny. You're buying it because you think it's going to go up. And selling it to you is selling it to you because they think it's going to go down. But so often we've seen in great big bull markets like the tech bull market in the 90s, these things went up and then they went up and then they went up and then they went up and they took a little dip down and they kept going up. That doesn't mean that you didn't have sharp corrections along the way, but the moves were staggering. So people who flip in their psychology and say, I have to own this thing, well, they're looking at the thing going higher. So are you going to have lived through the last however many years, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then sell to somebody on the cheap and let them ride Bitcoin from $250,000 to $5 million Bitcoin? Are you going to part with it? You say, oh, well, I'm rich now. I have 10 Bitcoin. I made myself $2.5 million. Gee, this is wonderful. Well, threw your Bitcoin away and you missed $5 million Bitcoin. That's $50 million in today's buying power. That would kind of suck. And I think that we find it so hard to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And so we see this over and over again in markets. When you sell, somebody's buying from you. They think it's going higher. They may be right. It doesn't mean that you didn't make money. Markets don't care what price you paid for something. You have to forget, it's not relevant what you paid for it. You might have paid $10 for it. That's not relevant. It's relevant to you. Sure, you've made a lot of money in it. But I think we have to think defensively. I think there are things that we do that are foolish and piggish. If you need the capital, if you want to enjoy some of it, great, do it. Sell it. Don't borrow against it. We should learn from March 12th and 13th that if we borrow, if we take on collateralized loans on our Bitcoin, there's a really good chance we get blown out of it. We're still going to have a very volatile market going forward. So, but that may change in 5-6 years. It may change in 4 years. But I'm dubious that, and I don't know the timing of this, so it might not be this cycle. So we might go to 288,000 and then shoot to 500,000, and maybe we go back down to 100,000. And so what I'm saying might not be right this cycle. At some point, though, here's what I want people to do a thought experiment of. If I am 50 years old, and I'm watching this asset go up that I thought had no credibility, and I see it print a price of $250,000. And I think, wow, I would have liked to have made money in that. When I see it sell off, at what price do I decide I want to step in and buy some of it? At what downside? 50% down? 30% down? 90% down? Where do I, if I feel that I've missed a trade, but I want to be in that trade, at what point do I want to start legging into that trade? I don't think we tend to think of this all the time, and you have to think what other people are going to want to do. I don't know what they're going to do, but I know we need to think about what they might want to do, because it will change the way the markets work. So just because something worked a particular way in the last 10 years doesn't mean that it's going to work that way in the next 10 years.
No doubt about that. CK, any reactions or thoughts before next question?
For the most part, I agree with Tina. If I were to add anything, I would say the most important thing for a Bitcoin investor is risk management. Like Tina said, a small amount of Bitcoin is actually worth, if Bitcoin succeeds, a lot more than you think. And you just want to put yourself in position where you don't have to sell when you don't want to. So I think that's the most important thing in being successful here is to protect yourself and stay defensive rather than put yourself in harm's way in order to, you know, potentially overexpose yourself. I think Brian Harrington at Brain Harrington on Twitter has been doing really great work around just like the personal finance angle of being a Bitcoiner. And this idea that you should always be increasing your bottom line, whether it's it's your Bitcoin or your USD bottom line, that side of your balance sheet should always, both sides of your balance sheet should always be going up. And you should always, again, be putting yourself in position where you don't need that Bitcoin investment to live, and you're not even considering it as something that's going to help you in the short term. It's just something that you're putting away for the future.
Sound advice. You don't want to overextend yourself. You don't want to be in a position where you have to sell that Bitcoin in order to survive. You want to be able to hold it for the long term. Corey, welcome to the call, man. How's it going?
You know, I don't usually go by CK2, but I'm cool with it. It's okay.
Corey Clipson. We got two CKs, Christian Carolus, Corey Clipson, CK Swan, and CK BTC Media.
Yeah. Hey, Tina, how are you, man?
Hey, CK.
All right. Somebody on Twitter just posted a GIF of like one of those like muscle-bound, over-steroided bulls as the avatar for Tina. And I think we should figure out how to display that when he's blank on one of these from now on.
Nice.
Send the video. I mean, Tina, you can upload it onto your Zoom. So
there you go.
That's what I gotta find the avatar.
Somebody DM that avatar to Tina.
I will.
See if we get it up. So we are just talking about, started talking about Bitcoin and treasuries, when Bitcoin might supplant treasuries at what market cap that might happen. We drifted into lots of different topics from there. But
I've been listening the whole show.
Yeah, cool.
I'm all up to speed.
Awesome. So you posed a question actually in the chat room. So why don't you go ahead and ask it? You're on here now.
Yeah, sure. So Tina, I know you've mentioned a Bitcoin super cycle, and you were starting to hint at least what the numbers might look like. But you know, we're kind of used to these 4-year epics and kind of what that looks like with our whole, you know, 2 to 3 data points. But what does it look like if, you know, things just go so nuts that it divorces from kind of the 4-year cycles, either this epic or the next one, and what might happen?
I think that's a real possibility. I think you have to open up your mind to the idea that that can happen, which is why I think you have to so carefully guard your Bitcoin and not sell it too cheaply. I mean, right now, we're at such a phenomenal price. I mean, guys like you, you're offering a service to people. So few people are going to take advantage of this soon enough. I look at Bitcoin at $9,000. It looks like it's free to me. Bitcoin at $9,000, to me, from my perspective, on a risk-reward basis, is a better risk-reward than it's ever been. It's cheaper than buying it at $10 because the upside is so much more likely.
Right.
Yeah, the likelihood is something that I think has really factored in. I got really noisy just kind of watching what was going on in late Feb, early March, and when the market started to, like, basically just like another demonstration that the legacy financial system is so incredibly messed up that it just won't survive in this form. And, you know, that because the life of Bitcoin to date has corresponded to the longest, largest bull market in history, it was hard to determine whether cracks would really show in the financial system or if it was different this time, right? Because we had very smart people saying that, hey, if you look at, you know, demography and, you know, essentially the end of 2018 crash, that, well, that was peak spending for Gen X, and it got picked up so quickly that maybe we now just go all the way through to like 2038, which should be peak spending for millennials. And this may just be like the biggest, you know, extended new normal or whatever. And in that scenario, you know, the likelihood of Bitcoin really taking off is somewhat less. So, you know, whatever your expectations were for price or for like timing for when Bitcoin becomes really important and really large, you need to, if you haven't made the adjustment in your head, like you're saying, Tina, where you're 2xing that, 5xing that, or 10xing that, or pulling that year forward. Like I used to say, I think, you know, you'd be able to use Bitcoin as a unit of account pretty much globally in a local currency and in Bitcoin by 2035. I've pulled that forward. I think that's probably more like 2030, you know, at latest. And then obviously
I agree with that. I think that's a real distinct possibility.
And then, yeah, when it comes to price and when we hit those milestones, you know, in my head, all those things are pulled forward. And when you think about, you know, Bitcoin companies and people building infrastructure, whether it's the Unchains or the Casas or us or, you know, whoever around the world that's building these Bitcoin companies, I think their likelihood of success has, you know, 5x'd or 10x'd, you know, if they're alive right now and doing some business, like this thing is going and you want to be involved.
If I could jump in, I totally agree with all of that. And I think I really love how Preston Pysh has entered the Bitcoin space, because I think that the way that he articulates a lot of this stuff is so clean. And I love the way that on the most recent Noted, where he appeared with Pierre and Michael Bitstein, he talked about the halving as kind of like being Bitcoin, like getting ready to make a crack at the king. And then if it fails, you know, it kind of dumps back and then kind of goes back into hibernation and tries to build up strength for the next go around. And thinking of these kind of like halvings and supply shock eras or epochs as like different attempts of Bitcoin kind of going for it, every time it gets stronger. Just between 2017 and now, the onboarding into Bitcoin, the education into Bitcoin, the memes proliferating. Like, we are living in this process of hyper-Bitcoinization in the world, waking up to what Bitcoin is. And eventually, it's going to head up the S-curve, and it's not going to fall back down from one of these bubbles. And that's why, again, it's so important to put yourself in position to not sell your Bitcoin. Put yourself in position to ride it, because this is going to be the biggest bull market in history. And, you know, when an idea and a technology meets the right opportunity and time, it's an unstoppable force. And it really seems as though Bitcoin has kind of wedged itself in the perfect opportunity in 2020 and beyond.
Well said, CK. We're only about 6x away from a $1 trillion market cap. It's about $55,000 per coin. To me, that's the big number, the quote-unquote big number ahead of us in this cycle. The $1 trillion market cap, what is that? What will that do in the financial world? What kind of waves that make and moves that will incent? Tina, what do you think?
Well, I think about it differently. I don't think the $1 trillion mark is that important. I see it very differently. For me, my model for how we get to $100,000 has always been the idea that people who are well-to-do, too rich, start to buy some Bitcoin, that they put on, people who are comfortable with trading in markets, people who trade for a living, Wall Street types, and types who also trade for a living who are not necessarily working on Wall Street, analysts, portfolio managers, hedge fund managers, salespeople, and that they put on a what the fuck position for their own account, for the what they call their PAs, their personal account. So you get a guy who's worth $5 million, $10 million, $20 million. Let's take a $20 million person. They put on a WTF, a what the fuck position, 1 or 2%. That's $200,000 to $400,000. Paul Tudor Jones put on a what the fuck position. His position is probably, what would we guess? 101% position, 50 million to $100 million what the fuck position. He's worth at least $5 billion. So, I think that a guy like Paul Tudor Jones gives a lot of intellectual cover for a lot of people to start thinking about putting on these positions.
Yeah.
And they're going to start thinking about it. So I think north of $20,000, the world starts to shift, and you're going to see this thing make it from 20,000 to 100,000 within about a year. Mm-hmm. So we get to 20 and we'll get to 100 within about a year, because people are not going to want to miss the trade. And if Tudor's doing it, maybe I should do it too, because he's amongst the very best traders who's ever lived. So he's now provided a massive level of intellectual cover. So I have my own speculations about this. Stanley Druckenmiller said that he learned from George Soros. Again, two of Druckenmiller is also one of the best traders who ever lived. that if you are right on something, you want to be right in large enough size that it matters. I'm pretty sure that Tudor probably thinks that way also. So I think 1% to 2% is his starting position, if I had to guess. Now, I'm just guessing. I don't know. I'm just guessing. He doesn't talk to me. My guess is that he owns physical Bitcoin and he'll trade futures against it for his PA, for his money under management and his funds. He'll probably use futures. This is a guy who's very comfortable trading. He probably trades more times a day than most people trade in their entire lives. So he's going to end up upping that position, and we're going to see an awful lot of people where it wasn't serious consideration start to put these trades on. That's a lot of money, and that's going to take to 100,000 pretty fast. A lot of eyes are going to pop out. JP Morgan Chase is now doing business with Gemini and Coinbase, and said they're going to do business with other exchanges. This is a huge about face. Mm-hmm. This is a huge public about face for this company. This is a really interesting start to this epoch. We have some major Wall Street hitters who have rung the bell. $9,000 Bitcoin is just so cheap.
Yeah, so you think it's more just the intellectual cover given by big names getting into Bitcoin and kind of justifying investment in Bitcoin, you know, more so than a big number in this cycle. Corey, any thoughts on what Tina has to say there?
So that's kind of a look at, so I have been following the Paul Tudor Jones thing very closely. It does appear that out of the fund, at least, which he's public about, we don't know what's in his personal account. Out of the fund, at least, it is supposedly low single digits. I've seen the $100 million number bandied about, which kind of makes sense because I think the specific fund is about a $4 billion fund, 4.1. So that would be like 2.5%, something like that. And it's, I think, a CME futures position. And I guess the max number of contracts you can have out as one fund basically nets out to like $100 million. So it's kind of all kind of squares there. Tina, I was actually just curious, like anecdotally, as we're kind of ramping up into what we hope is a face ripping bull run, just people from, you know, your generation, your social circle, people you talk to, you know, are you getting hit up a lot? So not the Paul Tudor Joneses, but the normies and whatever beautiful golf course laden community you live in, you know, what's it like? And are you hearing some noise?
I can only stand to talk to Bitcoiners, so I have no idea.
Okay, we'll have to have Gary Leland on the show again and talk about boomer outreach.
So I can talk a little bit about this topic. At least I would say so. I'm a millennial. Of millennials, I jumped into a couple of like chats with my normie friends, and they were talking about Bitcoin leading up to the halving. Talking to my girlfriend's mother, she has never been more upset with the government and has never asked me more questions about Bitcoin. People are waking up to this. And again, I'm not that smart. So I'm just going to keep quoting people that are much smarter than me that I listen to. But Jeff Booth has been kind of jumping in on the scenes on the Bitcoin space. And I love his example of how exponentials work and showing that in this idea of folding paper, right? Bitcoin is an exponential technology, and people don't understand that from fold 49 to fold 50, you go from taking a piece of paper to going all the way to the sun in terms of distance. And Bitcoin operates in the same way. So, you know, the last epoch we had the Coinbases of the world, and then in this epoch we have the Chase the JP Morgan Chases of the world and the SoFis and these massive institutions jumping in. Maybe the next one is when we start having significant countries jumping into this space. So as Bitcoin ramps up exponentially, adoption, respect, money flows, relevance to global commerce, they all increase exponentially. And just to kind of add on to that, whenever I hear people like fudding about Bitcoin fees in the future, it just pretty much shows that they don't understand what this exponential change looks like and what that means for Bitcoin's usage. Like talking about Bitcoin fees in any sort of like definitive way based on how fees are working today is just absolutely ludicrous and hilarious. So across the board, adoption is increasing exponentially. Awareness is increasing exponentially. Relevance is increasing exponentially. And maybe today you can't notice that, but in the next year, you're going to notice it. In the next 4 years, it's just going to be just jaw dropping. So it's just very, very difficult to reason with exponentials and this idea that if you fold a piece of paper 50 times, it makes it to the sun. Like that is an insane thing that people are just not aware of and not used to even contemplating.
Yeah, our brains just don't work that way. But yeah, we see, I mean, intuitively it's becoming, well, it doesn't happen intuitively in our brain, but it's becoming easier to observe as these exponential technologies and network effects pile up on each other and things just move, you know, faster and faster. And so Bitcoin is leveraging all of the, you know, the long history of the last century of exponential technologies and network effects, and you know, combining that with another technology that has had network effects, you know, innate forever, which is money. So you combine those two together, and yeah, like you know, Tina likes to say, you know, it's a NAD ripping sort of wake up call for a lot of people. I have another question from the chat room, and this is for the table, but we'll start with Tina. And this is a good one because it's sort of counterintuitive to expect that there might be deflation in a time of, you know, astounding money printing. So how is that possible, Tina, that, you know, we have deflation now or setting in as the Fed claims while we're printing enormous amounts of money?
The whole conversation of deflation and inflation is actually very complicated. A lot of the time when we're talking about deflation, we're talking about deflation of assets like stocks, like real estate. We're generally not talking about CPI, PPI deflation. Most of the deflation that we might see in those assets come because you've got enormous dollar-based loans outstanding, and those loans act as a depressant on the price of assets. So in a debt liquidation cycle, the way a debt liquidation cycle works is that as you pay down debt, you sell assets to pay down debt, the value of the assets go down more than the value of the debt, resulting in a worse ratio of your debt to your equity or your assets. I've heard a lot of people who I have a lot of respect for make a very strong argument for deflation. I used to make similar arguments. I've made it for years. The biggest mistakes I've ever made is making the arguments for deflation. Had I not been making those deflationary arguments, I would have bought a lot of things back in 2002. I would have bought a lot of those things back in 2009. I do think that an asset like Bitcoin, which has no counterparty risk, is ideal regardless. If you have significant asset price drawdowns, you don't want to be in an asset where you are dependent on your counterparty. Bank account's not your own. Brokerage account's not your own. In the event of a problem, hold on. In the event of a problem, you're a creditor. I'm not suggesting that this will be the case. We saw from MF Global in 2011, MF Global was ultimately bailed out, I think by SIPC, but I'm not positive. John Corzine was the CEO. He took some bets, I think, on some emerging market debt. I forget what emerging market debt he took. He was ultimately right, but it still pushed MF Global into, I think, bankruptcy. I'm not sure the exact details now. It's a long time ago. I'm pretty sure it's 2011. If you were a trader who cleared MF Global, you were not allowed on the floor where you were trading from. You didn't have access to your account. You were basically locked out of your account until they fixed those problems and paid you back based on SIPC and basically getting a bailout. Well, if you custody your own Bitcoin, you don't have that problem. Will the price be volatile? Yes, more than likely the price will be volatile, but you actually have your own asset. You have custody of your own asset. You can still transact with that. You might want to transact with it from one person to another. You might want to transact with it with an exchange. So the whole issue gets very difficult and very complicated. I think that we're going to see a shocking amount of spending, a shocking amount of monetization by the Fed. I expect the spending numbers to be well beyond what we think possible. We saw Fed balance sheets grow from $800 billion to $4 trillion. I think the balance sheet will grow a staggering amount in the coming years. I think that the spending will grow a staggering amount in the coming years. I've said before that I expected massive spending. I still do. I expect UBI. It's very hard to know how these things play themselves out. And to me, what's more important is owning assets that can withstand the scenario that we might go through. I feel very comfortable in having cash and having physical Bitcoin. I would advocate people should have cash because you never want to have to sell your Bitcoin. Look, Bitcoin could have a drawdown. Bitcoin could easily get cut in half. We've seen this happen over and over again. You have to have cash to be able to withstand periods of volatility. If you have income, you still want to have some cash because things can happen to your job. So you want to put yourself in a solid position of being able to ride these things through. So to me, at a minimum, having a cash and a Bitcoin position makes sense. Then you've got to figure out the ratio that makes sense to you. And I have no idea what ratio is right for you. What's right for you might not be right for me. I'm probably a lot older than you. I'll probably want a lot more cash than you're going to want. But these are very difficult things. And I tend to think that net-net, we will see longer run inflation. I'm not sure if we see asset inflation. I would not be surprised to see a flattish stock market. I've said it this way for a lot of years, that when you operate with a monetary policy that makes sense, your range of outcomes, of potential outcomes, is one set. But when you operate beyond the norms of historic monetary policy, which I think we've been operating on for a long time, I think you have a much larger set of potential outcomes. So it's very hard to know what the outcomes will be. I think that the outcomes that you need to expect that happen have to be much larger than the outcomes you think possible. I think there are more possible outcomes than we've ever seen before. And I'm not sure exactly what those will be. My only suggestion is you want to position yourself for a broad set of potential outcomes.
Sure.
I don't have a good answer for you. I wish I had a better answer for you.
Corey, what's your answer? Deflation versus inflation in this cycle? And why would we, even see deflation in a time when we're printing a bunch of money?
I'm just a consumer of information from all these macro guys that I've been learning from, but I've also been studying macro for 20 years now. So, I'll just give kind of what is starting to feel like the consensus view, which is that we're sort of in a deflationary environment for the next minimum 2 years and maybe as long as 5 to 7 years, but that you can't hide all this money printing forever. And so eventually it turns inflationary. But we've already seen, this, the April month was the the largest drop in the U.S. Consumer price index in since like the 30s or something like that. It was really, really drastic. I think 0.8%, still 0.4%, even when you strip out fuel. So I think that is, we're going to see falling prices. I think you're going to see when people actually get to start visiting homes when they've been blocked from going and looking at homes, and people have just been sort of, you know, surfing on rent forgiveness or rent delay or whatever. A lot of people are just going to be out of their homes now. And I think there will be a big drop in housing prices around the country. And, you know, obviously it'll vary market by market, but should happen. And we'll see how long that countervailing force plays out against all of the money printing. And they're going to try like crazy not to let deflation set in, because, you know, you literally, this country and no country around the world can pay their debts in a deflationary environment. They absolutely need inflation, and ideally higher inflation than historically, which is why we've seen the Fed, you know, as we've talked about a few times on with other guests on the show, you know, roll back the usual, like, let's stay under 2% and instead say, yeah, we're going to go ahead and like average 2% over the long term. And we don't know how far they're going to go back to pick up all those under years, because there's been a lot of them, and try to make it all even out over two. I mean, that gives them flexibility to target 3, 4, 5% in a year. We have no idea. So, you know, and when Tina starts to say, you know, okay, that's like 4 trillion, 5 trillion, like what, how much money are we going to print here? You know, we do have estimates from like Jim Bianco from Bianco Research, who's a popular guest on Eric Townsend's show, Macro Voices, saying that he thinks the number is 45 to 47 trillion. And you've had Chamath go on Jason Calacanis' new show and say that he thinks the number, I'm sorry, you know what? I'll give Pomp. This was actually on Pomp's show. I think that Chamath said he thought the number was 50 to 60 trillion that would need to be printed essentially to backstop everything that's broken around the world that, you know, more or less is dollar tied or dollar denominated. So it's going to be really, really, man, it's scary. What a time to be alive to watch, you know, this is really watching the world wake up from history. You know, we had a 30-year hangover after the end of the Cold War in 1990, and it's taken 30 years for people to, you know, it's just been this drunken celebration for the 30 years since then, you know, trying to keep the old institutions alive and trying to keep this, you know, this train on the tracks where everybody gets to be rich. And this is the wake up call. You know, take care of you and yours and get some Bitcoin.
I want to chime in one second. I think we're going to see massive inflation in Bitcoin. I'm very concerned the prices may go to $1 million of Bitcoin. I think we're going to see some truly terrible inflation in Bitcoin.
Sounds really scary. Are there enough sats? Are there enough sats to go around?
At least enough millisats.
Okay, millisats, good.
I think the person that has the person that makes the most sense to me right now, and he's not the only person with making this analysis, for me, is Ansel Lindner. So he's been on your show before, and I think his analysis of one, the euro dollar system, as well as the why am I blanking out on this on the term? But the repo markets, as well as the repo markets, is it just makes a lot of sense to me. And he's really painting like what is money is assets that can be swapped or that can be used as collateral in the repo markets. And the way that the repo markets are kind of architected is that they're architected in a way where if no one is accepting collateral, money is destroyed. Right, all of these assets that were counted quote unquote as money, as things that you can get liquidity out of, like they instantly become illiquid, and that has an effect of like money destruction. So I definitely see how the system, you know, is kind of levered in a way where if loans aren't being made, money is being destroyed very quickly. And what Tina kind of described is, you know, as people are trying to sell collateral to make up for their debts, the value of that collateral dumps much faster than the value of the debt. Again, I'm not an expert here, but I do really think that Ansel's analysis is at least helped kind of enlighten me a little bit. I also think a lot of the stuff that, you know, the Jeff Snyders and the people on Eric Townsend's show, Macro Voices, talk about Luke Groman about the euro dollar system and how that the dollar as a unit is not being controlled by the American Federal Reserve. The dollar as a unit is a global system. It's almost like a shadow banking free market system. And it's just really, really hard to see into it because it is something that is kind of outside of the purview of, you know, the Fed. So it's super, super complicated, no transparency in shadow banking. And I mean, it just like Tina said, like the future outcomes are so, so varied that the most important thing is to just hedge, put yourself in position to act defensively and put yourself in position to ride the wave.
I'm going to just put a little example on two of those things. So one of the assets that a lot of these guys like to use for collateral is like high yield debt. And because it was being marked down so quickly, the Fed decided to break all the rules that they'd ever had before and basically decide to backstop that market and buy up a bunch of it. And this is what a lot of people are forecasting will happen with equities as well, which is against the Fed's mandate. And they're not allowed to buy equities, but you know, at one point that was against the mandate of the Bank of Japan as well. And they own 80% of the ETF market in Japan. So, you know, this thing probably doesn't stay on the rails without massive social disruption, without the Fed buying stocks in the US. So that will probably, they'll do some sort of like judicial jujitsu and figure out some way to put that within their mandate or change some rule or something. They'll probably just use an SPV. It'll look a lot like Enron, frankly, which is what they did with the high yield thing already. They basically created like Raptor 7, just like the Houston guys did in 2001 or whatever. And then on the euro dollar thing, just to put like an example on that, you know, and a German bank can, you know, lend money to a Greek company and denominate that loan in dollars, basically, and in a credit, a system that relies on credit to create the money supply, which is what the dollar system is. It's a credit-based system. You know, essentially they're creating money right out of thin air there and saddling, you know, a Greek economy, let's say, that may have some trouble paying down a dollar-denominated debt over time if the dollar gets stronger over time and their economy goes to hell in a handbasket. They may have some trouble paying back that German bank, and that, you know, essentially affects the whole dollar system.
I want to throw a grenade into the discussion.
Sweet.
So I understand what people, I'm still very dubious about the idea of deflation. So we have to differentiate deflation. You're talking about deflation of assets like stock prices and real estate, or deflation in terms of CPI, PPI. So I don't think you'll see deflation in CPI, PPI at all. Asset prices, I expect to be staggering amount of spending. I expect stability of asset prices, and I expect the stock market may not go up very much, but I'm still not sure that a stock market will go down a lot. I think it'll actually be problematic for a lot of stockholders and they won't see it move forward. But here's the question. So if the US government were to issue 20, 30, 50-year paper, I have my AirPods talking to me. If the U.S. government were to issue 20, 30, 50-year paper with a 0% coupon and some small yield, 0.5%, 1% yield, which they might be able to do at some point, and then the Fed buys up most of that paper, was that money printing? And I think that is money printing, and I think that becomes very problematic for the markets, as much as seeing a sharp decline in asset prices. I think that what we've seen through each cycle is that policy responses get more and more aggressive. And the numbers that Chalmers threw out, the numbers that Bianca threw out, I don't find surprising and shocking at all. I think the numbers will be reached. I think the numbers will be astounding. And so what we have to ask ourselves is, if the politicians surprise us on the upside of what they do, then what do the outcomes look like? So that gets me back to owning Bitcoin, and it gets me back to owning physical Bitcoin. I don't happen to like stocks. I'm dubious that the real estate market will be either all up or all down. Selling New York apartments, they might be hit very hard in price, whereas buying apartments in the suburbs of New York, buying houses in the suburbs of New York might go up in price. It's not necessarily going to be all one or all another thing. So I'm not sure. To me, if they do something like that, that looks a lot like money printing. And we haven't seen them really do that before because we've never been in this situation. And imagine we have negative rates. What if you issued $20 trillion worth of paper with a minus 1% rate on the part of the U.S. government? That sure looks a heck of a lot like money printing. Things might not quite work out the way we expect them to. We always have to challenge our assumptions that we make. And I'm not sure if people making these views and giving these prognostications as to how they think things will work out are fully challenging the underlying assumptions. So what if the U.S. government issued $30 trillion of long-dated paper with a negative 1% yield? Then what?
Who wants to jump on the grenade?
Are they issuing faster than money is being destroyed globally is the question.
Up the number.
It's hard to tell.
Up the number. Up the number. Remember, they respond with greater and greater amounts each time. We've been more preemptive this time than we were in 2008 and 2009. Much more preemptive. Much more aggressive responses. I expect more aggressive responses. And I'm not just talking about the Federal Reserve, I'm also talking about politicians. So if we assume the world has to work out a certain way and people do the things that they did last time, then we might get results that we expect. But what if they don't do what they did last time and they change what they do? We have to open our minds to the idea that the responses may be different. Responses have already been different. I say vis-a-vis the Fed, and I would expand it beyond this, basic things you need to think about. There are no rules and whatever it takes. And so I'm very dubious of a deflationary outcome. I'm very dubious that it lasts that long. And if I had to bet, I would bet on many assets remaining stagnant. Maybe it's like your bathtub, where you are both letting the water drain out of the drain and water come in through your faucet. Net, net, much of that liquidity goes into Bitcoin. I think the ultimate outcome of this period that we see is a massive inflation in Bitcoin. I was joking when I said that, but I was actually serious. I think money flows into Bitcoin because it's the best asset to own. And I don't mean to always sound like this awful permabull who thinks Bitcoin's going to go to $3 to $5 million by 2030. I know that sounds crazy to nearly everyone, but that's what I think. Sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
You know, one thing I think is also kind of interesting, I'm trying to sort through this a little bit, is you know, we may have a little bit of a recency bias thinking that this crisis, you know, is similar to the last one, you know, which was really just a financial crisis. And this one is like a global economic crisis in every way. And, you know, last time it was the subprime bubble and this time it's the everything bubble. And, you know, also the relative standing of the US versus the rest of the world has only strengthened in the last 12 years as the Eurozone has shown its cracks and, like, you know, no other country is really doing all that well. And so, you know, my broad take there is that probably what happens is some really crazy shit happens elsewhere in the world because of this crisis. And then it comes back and essentially bites the US in the ass because of second and third order effects and, you know, just the interaction of all kinds of different actors and occurrences in a complex system. But, you know, thinking that just using the same tools that we used last time and only thinking about the inputs and the outputs in the same way and using the same language and the same paradigm as we did in 2008, 2009, you know, we're just kind of missing the entire fourth quadrant of all the unknown unknowns, right? So again, I can only think of one hedge for stuff you can't know about. And it's actually owning an asset that no one can change your ownership of. And that's why I think it's such a good time to be in conversations like this. And I'm almost done listening to Peter Zion's book, Disunited Nations. And then he's been on the interview circuit giving updated talks sort of in a post-COVID world and kind of updating his thinking on the interplay of different countries and nations around the world and what this means essentially for pulling the future forward by at least a decade or so and watching what probably would have taken 1 to 2 decades play out over the next 2 years. So can't recommend anyone highly enough to supplement some of your Bitcoin listening and your macro listening, listen to some geopolitics as well. He's somebody I've been reading and listening to for the last 12 years or so, and he's pretty awesome.
I think he's a good storyteller. I was very unimpressed on his understanding of Bitcoin. He gave the standard answer of governments won't allow it.
Yeah, he doesn't understand Bitcoin, but that's not what I listen to him for. You know, I don't listen to Taleb for his views on Bitcoin either. You got to pick and choose, man.
As long as you're careful.
Yeah, his books don't talk about Bitcoin. He Pomp hit him with some Bitcoin questions at the end of his recent appearance, and he has no idea what he's talking about. But neither does Eric Townsend. Eric Townsend wrote a book on blockchain and thinks this is going to be like central bank digital currencies. He really doesn't understand Bitcoin at all. And he's, you know, my number one guy to listen to for macro stuff. So we know about Bitcoin. They can ask us.
Well, hey, I have to bounce out, but I've never seen more people that are well positioned to learn about Bitcoin just being in part of the conversation in Bitcoin. And it's slowly but surely more and more of these guys like the Eric Townsends are going to start to have their eyes opened to Bitcoin. And like Tina said, once Bitcoin hits that 20K mark again, I think that's when every single macro investor and hedge fund manager, you know, has Bitcoin on their balance sheet and has a thesis around it.
Awesome. Well, thanks, CK. I can be the only CK. Let's keep going for a couple more minutes.
Peace out, y'all. Thanks for having
later.
Me.
Later.
Later, CK.
Yeah, I think the big numbers are 20, 50, and 100. You know, I think it's the denominations that we're used to, and those are numbers that everybody kind of can like do quick math on based on, you know, 20 million-ish Bitcoins and, you know, 20 being the all-time high. And yeah, I think that's each one of those, I think, will have like blow off tops. Like it'll pass 20 and it'll go to like 40 before coming down to like 28 again. And then it'll go, you know, slowly up, well, slow in relative terms, you know, up to 50, and then it'll just like blow through that and then pull back. And I have no idea what happens when this thing goes over 100K. It's going to be insane.
How insane is it going to be when it's over $288,000?
I don't think any different than 287. I was 288.
No, that's Plan B's number. But the point is, how crazy is it at 300? I think we so underestimate what it's going to be like to be buying an asset which is price inelastic supply with a fixed amount. I think it's so hard to understand what that really means. And I think the upside is going to be so surprising. And people who are so desperate to own it and will be buying it. And it's, when we sell stocks that are crashing, we're desperately reaching for cash. When we sell the things that we own to buy Bitcoin, we're desperately selling those things to buy the new cash, the new money. I think it's so hard for us to invert our thinking as to what this is going to be like. And I just think that the coming bull market is going to be so much harder than the last 2.5+ years, because the numbers are going to go up on a relative basis. That doesn't mean tomorrow. I'm talking about over the course of the next year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe four. So it's not a tomorrow thing. So don't assume that I mean that. I don't mean that. But it will feel incredibly fast. And I asked this question earlier. Let me ask you, Corey. If you've never been in Bitcoin. You're a well-to-do guy, trader, used to trading in stocks. You've watched this thing go to $250,000, $300,000. It sells off. At what point in a sell-off do you say, I have to buy some here? When do you say, you know, let's assume that 300 is the top. At what point do you say, I need to buy some? Do you wait till it's down 50%? Do you wait till it's down 80%? Do you wait till it's down 30%? When do you start to put your toe into buying that thing that you watched, that you thought was garbage, and you watched go to what seems like a crazy number to you?
So my answer to that is, it has so much to do with how well Bitcoin, the Bitcoin community, and then just like the general press actually educates accurately about Bitcoin. Because what I don't have a good gauge on is, you know, because I was not here for the last halving or not really paying attention. I really got drawn in by the price rise in early 17, is whether you were sitting there in 2016, 2017 as a Bitcoiner who'd been around for 3 years or 6 years or whatever, and you thought that you had enough visibility by the outer world that, you know, that you could see something like that. Like, you wouldn't ever see a really, really dark, deep bear trough again. And so that's the argument that we're making now, is saying like, okay, is there enough literature out there? Are there enough people speaking about this? You know, is Paul Tudor Jones and Chamath and a few other Peter Thiel types, like, is that enough? Or does it need to be, you know, 10x that number of names that really understand Bitcoin and care about it and buy it and tell their friends too, for us to avoid, you know, an 80% drawdown? But I don't think there's any chance that we're not there after the following cycle. I think it's, you know, maybe a coin flip. I don't know. You got to handicap it somehow. Like, maybe we're there this one or not, where, you know, yeah, you see $150,000 Bitcoin and you're like, it's just too cheap. Even if it goes down from here, I know it's going back up because it always does. And yeah, you soften that cycle at, you know, a drawdown of 30% or 50% or something, instead of having to go 80, 85% down. I don't know if it'll be this cycle that, and essentially I think that is kind of the definition of a super cycle, where the pullback just never really quite, the traditional, you know, full bear doesn't actually happen and you just go up again. But I'm pretty damn certain that'll happen by the one following.
How do you guys think that, sorry, Tina, go ahead and then I'll ask a follow-up.
I maintain this is the first mainstream bull market. I maintain that pretty much nobody knew about Bitcoin last time. I bought Bitcoin in that, started buying Bitcoin in 2017 as well, but I maintain that pretty much nobody knew about it. The world just got a slight inkling at the peak in 2017, but then dismissed it as being another Charles McKay extraordinary popular delusions and madness of crowd story, like the South Sea bubble, the Mississippi bubble, or tulip mania. And so I don't think that last go round was a mainstream bull market. You have companies like Fidelity. You have companies like JP Morgan Chase doing business with these guys. My guess is that come 2022, 2023, you're going to have a lot more players, big name, marquee name players involved in buying and selling Bitcoin. You're going to have players coming in, figuring out how do they not let this thing pass them without getting involved. So my guess is that the downside softens pretty substantially. What that means, I'm not quite sure what that amounts to being. So here's the next follow-up question to that. If you only go down 30 to 40%, when is the right time to sell your Bitcoin to try to make more of it? I'm talking as a U.S. citizen, somebody who pays taxes. So as somebody who pays taxes. And so even if you pay 20% capital gains tax, so not there are places out there that they don't pay taxes, so that answer is different. But assuming you pay taxes, with a 30 to 40% drawdown, where's the right place to sell in order to try to make more of it?
You just hodl, bro. No point.
The answer is never. There's never. No right place to sell, because you won't get it right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing I wrestle with. And I think there's a really good chance. And I don't think we're thinking that way. I think practically everyone thinks, where can I sell so I can make more Bitcoin? And I think the risk to most Bitcoiners, the biggest risk to most Bitcoiners today, is that thought process of where do I sell so I can make more Bitcoin? For many people, if they make that choice to sell, not to sell to pay for expenses, not to sell to say, okay, I need to sell some because I need to carry myself for a year, 2 years, 3 years of expenses, depending on what you do, if you have an income, if you don't have an income. But I mean to sell to where you're trying to trade to make more Bitcoin. And I think that's a really serious risk for a lot of Bitcoiners. You may have been an early Bitcoiner. You may have what 10 years from now is really a lot of Bitcoin. You may have 10 Bitcoin, which would be a lot of Bitcoin in a world of $5 million Bitcoin. That's worth $50 million in today's buying power. That's a lot of money. 10 Bitcoin doesn't seem like a lot to people. I mean, sure, if you have half a Bitcoin, 10 seems like a lot. But in the scheme of the world's investments, $90,000 isn't a lot of money. It is, but it's not. If you're worth $5 million, $90,000 is not a lot of money. If you're worth $100 million, $90,000 is not a lot of money. But compare $90,000 buying power to $50 million of buying power. And that's the world I think we're going to. And I'm talking to people who are 25 and 30 and 35 years old. You're only going to be 10 years older, maybe 12 years older. That's a lot of money. You're really rich with $50 million. And so I'm so afraid for so many Bitcoiners that they're going to try to get more and they're going to wind up having much less because they don't value what they own. And I'm so worried about this. And I said to Plan B the other day, I said, actually, I've become more convinced of the idea of stock to flow with the fact that Bitcoin has traded the way it has traded. I thought we're going to be at $50,000 Bitcoin come the halving, and we weren't, of course. But it's fascinating the way this thing works. And I'm so excited to see what happens in the coming few years, because I really think Plan B has an amazing model. And we're going to find out, you know, if we can't make it to 100,000, which I think is pretty unlikely, then, you know, I'm going to have to reevaluate my views. I feel pretty confident I'll be right. But if I am right, you really need to value what you have. You're sitting on top of, it's like being in Texas. And you've got this massive reservoir of oil underneath you that's worth a fortune. And you're going to let somebody come in and buy it from you. And they're going to pay you pennies on the dollar. Don't sell it to them. You have to really understand what this is. It's like buying on the island of Manhattan, in Midtown Manhattan in 1800. And it looks like farmland. But it's going to become New York City, and it's going to be worth more money than you can imagine in not that many years. And this is my biggest concern for Bitcoiners. They really have to be so cautious about not parting with that Bitcoin at too cheap a price. And I don't think we get this. And I still think even the most diehard hodler will be thinking, where can I sell some? And I want to sell some, and for good reasons. I want to sell it for a house. I hear people say this all the time. I want to sell it for a house. That's worth a house. That's great. But what if you're selling it for that house, which is a beautiful house? It's a $200,000-$400,000 house. But what if that house is really costing you, instead of that beautiful $300,000-$500,000 house, what if that's really a mansion on the ocean with 20 acres, it's really a $40 million piece of land with a house on it, and you sold it for $400,000. And this is what I'm thinking. And I know I'm very crazy in my views.
Hey, well, we wanted a bull on the show.
We got one.
Awesome.
One last question, and then we can wrap it up. As long as you got a few more minutes, Tina.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. So I'm curious what you guys think about, you know, Cash App has, you know, I guess published numbers, $300 million of the Bitcoin bought in the first quarter, which it came out to be something like about a quarter of all freshly mined Bitcoin. We obviously expect that to be going up this quarter and moving forward. And with services, you know, they have recurring buys now, services like Swan and recurring buys and that DCA mentality really spreading among Bitcoiners. How do you think the, you know, automated purchasing of Bitcoin, a regular buy, a cumulative regular buy of, you know, millions and millions of dollars every week, month by Bitcoiners will affect the stability of the price?
You want a TNA to go first?
Yeah, I don't know how it affects. I don't know how it affects the stability of the price, because I think you're going to see a lot of people with fairly large buying power come in. So, like I said, the example, the guy who's worth $5 million, which, you know, a guy who's 40 to 60 is worth $5 million, who trades stocks for a living. So if they decide to put on what I call a what the fuck position, 1%, that's $50,000. That's a lot of buying versus, you know, $50 or $100 a week or a month. So I think there'd be a fair number of those people. So I don't know what it does for stability. What it will do is the more Bitcoin that's held widely and widely distributed, people who hodl it tightly and hold on to that and are not willing to part with that Bitcoin, it's going to make Bitcoin's price extremely unstable on the upside.
Yeah.
And you're going to see prices go to crazy, you know, crazy, crazy numbers. I think it's a fabulous base to have.
Yeah, which is, you know, increases that floor. So I think that gets to this idea that the downside of on the bear cycle, you know, won't be as bad moving forward. Maybe, you know, like Corey said, we won't even get into some kind of like regular bear cycle as we think about it. Corey, what's your thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just it's a cool number to think about. But, you know, the supply of Bitcoin that's for sale on any given day is all the Bitcoin that's on all the exchanges, or that could be, you know, very quickly, you know, brought out for the right price.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I think probably the best way to look at that is like, you know, what has moved. So these charts that you see of, you know, coins that haven't moved in 5 years, 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, whatever. So,
yeah,
you know, it seems like there's generally like 3 or 4 million Bitcoin, you know, for sale over the next few months. So it's a cool target and it's fun to talk about, but I think there are a lot more, interesting things, you know, interesting forces and dynamics at play than that. Mm-hmm. You know, I just look at it as like, how cool is it if you're sucking up all of the supply? I just think that's awesome. And, you know, there have been periods where one place, you know, sometimes the markets actually do get very thinly traded. So one place, I'll argue the other side of it. You know, there are times when there's just so little appetite for Bitcoin for whatever reason. And if there's always somebody, you know, on the bid because there's all these automated auto stacking platforms like Swan and Cash App, and obviously Coinbase and Gemini have this as well, even though they overcharge by an arm and a leg. it could actually make a big difference and kind of smooth out and get rid of some of those, you know, like cascading margin call type situations and things that might happen when there's low liquidity and, you know, just like a break in the news cycle or something like that. So maybe that does actually matter at some point over the next couple of years. So I argued both sides.
Love it. I love it. All right. I think it's time to wrap up. I will give you a chance at some brief closing words, Tina and Corey, if you want, before we close this thing up.
The most important words, other than number go up, the most important words in Bitcoin are gradually, then suddenly.
Corey?
All right. Yeah. that's a pretty good one. I'm just going to use the last couple of seconds here to shill a little bit for anybody still on. If you go to swanbitcoin.com/halving and sign up, we'll top you off with $10 of free Bitcoin, and also donate $5 to Bitcoin OpTech for everyone who comes in through that link. And then we also just launched our global referrals program. So even though we only have US customers, we now have people from all over the world that have gone and signed up at swanbitcoin.com/earn and are spreading the good word about Bitcoin and about Swan and earning some sats, and those payouts are in Bitcoin, which is pretty cool as well. So that's kind of the cool things we got going on. And yeah, it's just been a stunningly fast ride here over the first 6 weeks. We launched March 30th and we're not quite halfway through May. We're now buying about 3.5 million of Bitcoin annualized on an annual basis for our customers. So that's a good number to hit. And just crossed 600 customers a couple days ago. So that was a good one, good number. I'm sure we'll be charging toward 1,000 pretty quick. I think our five biggest sign-up days have all been in the last, 8 days or something like that. So business is picking up. People like Bitcoin. Check out Swan. Shill ended.
SwanBitcoin.com.
We sponsored this podcast.
We do. All right. Thanks, Tina. Thanks to Christian for joining us. Of course, Christian works at BTC Media, Bitcoin Magazine. He also has the POV Crypto podcast that he co-hosts along with his Ethereum friend. So if you want to hear Christian defend Bitcoin against the Ethereans, that's a fun one to get into sometimes. Bitcoin Tina is our favorite permable, and you can find him on Twitter at Bitcoin Tina. Thanks for your time, man. Thanks, Corey. SwanBitcoin.com. Go start your auto stacking.
Guys, that was fun. We're still on.
We're here. We
stop the live stream.
It still says recording, though.
No, yes, that's fine. We are recording, but we're not live. Thanks to Tina and CK for joining us. You can follow Bitcoin Tina at Bitcoin Tina. That's BITCOINTINA. And in case you're wondering, TINA is an acronym. It stands for There Is No Alternative, as in there's no alternative to Bitcoin. And thanks to Christian as well for joining us, of course. You can follow Christian at CK_Snarks, SNARKS, on Twitter. Subscribe to the Swan Signal podcast at swansignalpodcast.com. And on behalf of the Swan team, thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can join us live next time, as I noted, on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, or Twitch. Jump into our Swan Signal Telegram chat room. We have a lively crew there that chats throughout the week, but also during our live conversations. You can be in the room and ask questions. It's a lot of fun. You can find the chat on Telegram at t.me/SwanSignal. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. We are the best way to accumulate Bitcoin. We have automatic recurring buys. You can also automatically withdraw to your wallet. We are focused on stacking sats, not trading. We have no distractions here at Swan Bitcoin, no altcoins. We're forever Bitcoin only. And we are committed to Bitcoin education with content like this podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Swan Bitcoin and subscribe to the podcast again at swansignalpodcast.com. That's it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us.